This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Last month, when the Obama administration rejected the application to build the Keystone XL pipeline, environmentalists hailed the decision as a major victory. For years, they'd opposed the massive project, which would have carried oil from the tar sands of Alberta across the U.S. south to the Gulf Coast.
The opponents were impressively focused, up against powerful interests, including the Canadian company TransCanada, the U.S. gas and oil industries, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Among their leaders is the Vermont-based journalist, author, and now activist, Bill McKibben. McKibben is the author of The End of Nature and a scholar in residence at Middlebury College.
And he was among the 1,200 protesters arrested outside the White House last summer. And in this era of the Occupy movement, with its mix of agendas and goals, we wanted to talk to Bill McKibben about global warming as well as about focused, and for now at least successful, political activism. And he joins us from his home in Vermont. And Bill McKibben, great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for doing this. We appreciate it.
Hey, what a pleasure to be with you.
So concern, here's my first question. Concern about global warming has been on the agenda for a while now. What was it in particular about the Keystone XL pipeline that inspired you to lead this opposition to it?
Well, last spring, my friend Jim Hansen at NASA, who's really the world's foremost climatologist, his team put out a little paper saying, you know what, this tar sands in Canada is actually a big deal. It turns out to be the second largest pool of carbon on the planet, second only to the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. Now, it's burning Saudi Arabia more than anything else that's raised the temperature of the earth about 1 degree so far and given us this, you know, wild weather that we're experiencing and all the other early onset effects of climate change. If we find the next Saudi Arabia and just do the same thing, then we're, you know, then we're foolish. And more than anything else, I mean, Hansen, who's a very straightforward scientist, said, look, if we burn the tar sands, doesn't matter much else what else we do, it'll be game over for the climate.
That's what the way he put it.
That's how he put it. And then 20 of the nation's top scientists put out a letter saying this is not in either the nation's or the planet's best interest. That convinced me it might be worth going to work.
Well, I want to talk to you about that work. But first, let me just ask you about the response, first of all, from Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who says that Canada will now seek to, in his words, diversify its portfolio. And that could mean the sale of the oil to China, which Harper has said before that Canada would do. So doesn't this oil end up coming out of the ground anyway?
Well, maybe. But, you know, if you look at a map, Alberta's a long ways from anywhere else. And to get it to China, first they've got to get it to the Pacific. So they have indeed proposed building a new pipeline called the Gateway Pipeline that would go to British Columbia. But boy, they're doing a better job of opposing that than we did on Keystone. A big majority of Canadians now oppose this new pipeline. It's drawn more comments than any energy project or any project in Canadian history. The Canadian government just announced that they were going to take an extra year to review the environmental qualifications, which is just what President Obama wanted to do with the Keystone thing. And the First Nations, what they call Indigenous people in Canada, are unanimously against it, and it's their land against which it's got to cross. So frankly, I think it's going to be a long while before they get it out. Look,
another tough fight.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is, given enough time, they'll probably find a way out. We've got to take what little reprieves we can get from these temporary victories to make the case around the world continuously that climate change is such a challenge that we should not even be thinking about getting at this oil.
And speaking of reprieve, or sort of brief reprieve, let me ask you about that, because is that how you would characterize the Obama administration's rejection? Because as you know, the rejection came as a result of a fight with Republicans who wanted the administration to rule right away. The administration said that doesn't give enough time, so they rejected it. But President Obama said the decision was not a judgment on the merits of the pipeline.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And look, the Congress is already, I mean, today they're introducing new, we're going to attach it to this bill and that bill and go with the payroll tax. And that big oil is, owns Congress, and they'll do whatever they can to reverse this. Environmentalists never win permanent victories. We only win temporary ones, and this may be very temporary. Hmm. In certain ways, the biggest use of it was simply to show that if people are willing to stand up, we can find some other currencies, passion, creativity, spirit, our bodies sometimes, to put on the line against the one asset the fossil fuel industry has, which is money.
Well, that's interesting. You and thousands of others, or I guess 1,200 or so others, did put your bodies on the line. And I want to ask you about that. But first, I want to encourage our listeners to join this conversation. We're talking to author and environmental activist Bill McKibben, and we're asking you what you see in his opposition to the Keystone XL pipeline. What does it say about how to organize politically? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Bill, let me ask you about that subject that you just brought up. You were up against big interests. You are. You don't have the money to compete. So what was the key element of your strategy to oppose this?
Well, certainly one of the things we did was say, maybe we can spend our bodies as the kind of ante to get into this game. And we put out a call for people to come to Washington, and you know, I wrote a letter, and it got signed by a few of my friends, the great essayist Wendell Berry and the writer Naomi Klein and some others. And we were really, really heartened by the response. So many people showed up that over 2 weeks, those 1,253 arrests being the biggest civil disobedience action in about 30 years in this country. And I think what it demonstrated, frankly, was that there's just a lot of people were very, very worried about global warming especially, and that given something concrete to do, you know, there's a chance that we can build a little momentum. We're not anywhere near winning. Stopping one pipeline, you know, we're not going to stop global warming one pipeline at a time. We're trying to continue all this. We're sort of on the offensive in ways we can think of. We're around the country now, people mounting a kind of opposition to the subsidies that are annually given the fossil fuel industry by our Congress, a completely ludicrous exercise given that these are the most profitable industries on earth. But, you know, they, as I said before, they own the Congress, and I wasn't speaking, you know, hyperbolically. They give legislators small presents, and then legislators give them huge presents with our tax money. And it should stop. We had 500 people in referee uniforms up on Capitol Hill last week, just making the point that in every other sphere of our life, this wouldn't be right. If Robert Kraft had paid the referees before last night's Super Bowl, well, the Patriots might have won.
might have had a lot of people around New England feeling a little better but, this morning.
But right? Actually, yeah. You know, if we'd found out, nobody, including us Patriots fans, would have liked it. We would have all been shocked and outraged. For some, you know, if it happened at your daughter's junior high school gymnastics meet, you'd be shocked and outraged. For some reason, we've convinced ourselves it's just what happens in Congress. But it's not right that you should take money from companies and then vote on their interests. And we really need it to stop.
You mentioned subsidies for oil companies. I wanted to play a clip from the president's State of the Union address about this, in which he spoke out against federal subsidies for oil companies. Let's just listen.
We've subsidized oil companies for a century. That's long enough. It's time to end the taxpayer giveaways to an industry that rarely has been more profitable and double down on a clean energy industry that never has been more promising. Pass clean energy tax credits. Create these jobs.
That was President Obama at the State of the Union address last week. And we're talking to Bill McKibben, who is one of the key opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline. And we're talking about environmental activism and political organization. What do you hear in his story? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Bill McKibben, I want to ask you about your sort of connection and your involvement or sort of your talks with the Obama administration. My understanding is before you were arrested, you also met people at the White House about what you wanted. What was your message to the Obama administration in terms of what the environmental movement would deliver to them or not?
No, I confess I'm not very connected in Washington. I've never been inside the White House in my life. And you know, there are environmentalists in Washington who are good at conveying these messages, and they were backing, you know, the work that we were doing on this pipeline. You know, all the big environmental groups sent a note to the president saying there's not an inch of daylight between our position and those people getting arrested outside your house. But I confess I'm not particularly wired in that way. I think the message that the White House understands, and that really anybody who looks at this who doesn't work for the oil companies understands, is if we're serious about jobs and things, the jobs are to be found when we make the decision to turn our back finally on more endless addiction to fossil fuel and start putting up the solar panels and the wind turbines in really large numbers. That's, you know, if you build an oil pipeline, we think it'll create about 3,000 jobs for about 2 years. That was the highest sort of number that anyone other than TransCanada has come up with for the job impact. If you start putting up serious number of solar panels, think of the people swinging hammers that's going to take for decades. The point of building an oil pipeline is you never have to employ anybody again. You know, you just have a pipe in the ground that you pump this stuff through. But the great thing about the renewable energy economy is it has to happen here. No one's going to send their house to China to get it insulated. You got to go hire one of those guys who's no longer building McMansions, because we don't need McMansions.
I heard you say a while ago, I think it might have been as far back as 2009, that when it comes to what has to happen with regard to global warming, you can't do what needs to be done with the current constellation of political forces. And I'm wondering, given what happened, is that still the case? Or does the Keystone XL decision suggest that something significant has shifted with the current constellation of political forces?
I think the constellation of political forces is still firmly in place. And, you know, we may well see them roll back this small win on Keystone. But what we've done a little bit is kind of expose where that's coming from, begin to make the connections between the fossil fuel industry and their political supporters, make it clear that this really is an emperor without any clothes, and try finally to make people understand, get people to understand where the future actually lies. This is very hard because these guys run tens of thousands of TV commercials around the clock and so on and so forth, all designed to instill fear and make people think that any shift from the status quo will, you know, leave us freezing in the dark. But it's simply not true. We have real possibilities on this planet, but we're foreclosing those possibilities fast. We have that sense of that in Vermont right now because we just came through the biggest weather disaster by far in the state's history.
You're talking about the flooding that occurred there not long ago. Right?
The state damn near washed away. Hmm. You know, and we can't afford it. We cannot. I'll be up in Montpelier tomorrow testifying at the legislature. And, you know, all these guys are trying to do is figure out how on earth they're going to pay for all the bridges and roads and things that
had a big disaster up there and definitely linked to the environment. Bill McKibben, stand by because I want to get some callers in. We've got a couple of them backed up that would like to give you to ask you a question or two. Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to reach Bill McKibben. And let's go to Caleb, who's calling from the South End. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well.
I just thought in terms of as a strategic marketing idea for the climate change is to really drive home the human consequences. Like you just brought up with the hurricane in Vermont. It's to go as conservative as possible as the models predict, but talk about, you know, people who are arguing that being for the environment is being against jobs, to bring up the point that do you really want a job in the oil industry if it's going to mean that someone in the developing world that's subject to drought is going to suffer for it?
And Caleb, are you suggesting that the environmental movement isn't hitting that message hard enough in your view?
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, let's get Bill McKibben to respond.
Right.
Yeah, okay, go ahead, Bill.
Caleb's absolutely right. Amen, brother. Look, we run this thing, this global grassroots climate network called 350.org, and In April, we'll be having this day around the globe we're going to call Connect the Dots, and where people in literally thousands of places, we work in every country except North Korea, people in thousands of places who are already suffering the effects of climate change are going to be saying to the rest of the world, stop it. We cannot take this anymore. We can't deal. You know, we've had, in the United States alone last year, we had 14 multi-billion dollar weather disasters. That broke the old record of 9 set the year before. We just can't deal with it anymore. Thailand just had the biggest flooding in their history in November. We didn't pay that much attention to it, but they sure did, because the damage it did was equivalent to 18% of the country's gross domestic product. Mm-hmm. That's 25 times more economic damage than Katrina did in this country. We just cannot keep doing this. And the point, the sort of point that's beginning to get out there, and I'll tell you a funny story about the arrests that kind of made this point if you want. The point that's starting to get out there is the environment, the oil companies are the radicals here. It's not those of us protesting. The story is, when we went down to Washington to get arrested, I said to everybody, if you want to come, you need to be wearing a necktie or a dress, because we need to get across the point that in this case, we're really the conservatives trying to hold on to the world we were born into. It's oil companies that every day are working to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere, even though the world scientists told them this is the most dangerous thing that civilization has ever encountered. That is radical in a way. I mean, if you are making a new Bond film, you know, it's the kind of thing you'd have the villains doing. Give me a $1 trillion or I will wreck the chemical composition of the atmosphere.
Well,
it's
Bill McKibben,
crazy.
Let me suggest one thing that has changed. When I asked you if the current constellation of political forces has shifted, you said maybe not. But one thing that has shifted is your notoriety. And as an example of that, I want to play another cut. This is from your appearance last November on the Colbert Report, November 2011. Let's just listen for 30 seconds.
The president has delayed the approval of this pipeline. He's kicked the can down the road, all because of pressure from guys like you. Are you celebrating all the loss of jobs? Do you have some hybrid vehicle that runs on broken dreams?
The truth is, the only study of this pipeline not funded by TransCanada, the company that wanted to build it.
Right, they should know. They should know it's their pipeline, but go ahead.
The only study that they didn't pay for showed there'd be exactly zero new jobs net. The real jobs come when we get off big oil and decide to move.
So, Bill McKibben, that was your experience with Stephen Colbert, which must have been interesting. But
it's always fun. I've been twice now, and I think I'm going to be there again next week, actually.
Well, let me just ask you, because it does actually lead to an interesting question, and that is, you're in a way, you're an unlikely leader of this movement. You're a journalist by trade, mild-mannered, thoughtful, not necessarily a loud, rabble-rousing type. Is it a natural fit for you?
No, it's the exact opposite, and I'm terrible at it. You know, I wrote the first book about climate change 23 long years ago, a book called The End of Nature, back when I was, you know, came out in The New Yorker. I was a New Yorker writer as a young man. And I figured that was my job, you know, to write about these things, and that someone else would figure out how to make them happen. And at a certain point, it just became clear to me that it wasn't happening. We weren't building the kind of movements that we needed to counter that power of the fossil fuel industry. So, you know, we started 350.org, literally me and 7 undergraduates at Middlebury, each one of their 7 continents. So each one of those kids took a continent and went to work. The guy who took the Antarctic had to take the internet too.
Bill, let's
built this big network.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I just want to get a couple more calls in here because there are a lot of people who want to talk to you. Let's go to Charles in Scituate. Hi, Charles.
Hi there.
You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm very sad that Bill McKibben and many others like him are whining about the situation, because it is very bad, but there are concrete answers, and apparently Bill is not aware of it or dismisses these answers. And in particular, I would like to point out a book written by Rhys Paley It's called The Answer. And if I could just read a couple of things on the inside flap of the book.
Well, Charles, if you can make the point quickly, because we'd like to get back to Bill, and I want to take your point on board. So just, sure, go ahead.
Well, okay, it's very simple on the flap. In this book, Rhys Paley argues that wind, solar, and hydroelectric power, all of which have large CO2-emitting footprints, are not the answer we need to make meaningful changes in our disastrous warming trend. Nor, for both economic and political reasons, can large nuclear power plants be built in time.
So what is the answer?
He goes on in the flap to say that the only sensible answer, which the author backs up with exhaustive research, is the construction and deployment of container-sized nuclear generators distributed throughout the world, producing clean energy at the local level.
So many nuclear plants at the local level. We got it, Charles, and I'm glad you brought this to our attention. Bill McKibben, is Charles on to something?
I don't know the book. The knock on nuclear, the current generation of nuclear things are not only the obvious safety issues, which are more pungent post-Fukushima, but also the fact that they're incredibly expensive. And hence not really a big player anyplace. I think that really we're going to find out what the alternatives that work best are the day we put a serious price on carbon. At the moment, the whole debate is so skewed by the fact that the fossil fuel industry has this unique advantage. They're allowed to pour their waste into the atmosphere for free. Unlike any other business on Earth, they get to just use the atmosphere as an open sewer. And hence, we really, the price of fossil fuel doesn't reflect its cost. If it did, then the possibilities and the incentives for innovation and everything across 1,000 different technologies would really propel what we're already seeing, this move towards all different kinds of renewables. My guess is it'll look different in different places. There are places where the sun and the wind make tremendous sense. I get my hot water here in Vermont off the solar thermal panels on the roof. In that regard, I'm like 250 million Chinese.
But I wonder, Bill, just to pick up on our caller's point, the idea of small, miniature nuclear reactors. I know risks are associated with nuclear reactors, but it is relatively clean. I mean, I'm just wondering if it makes sense for environmentalists to sort of join forces with that idea, and you'll sort of bring more people into the conversation.
I don't know much about miniature nuclear reactors, partly because there aren't any, which to look at the moment and get at. I do think that in general, small and miniature and distributed are where we're going. The logic of fossil fuel is very centralized. This stuff is concentrated, rich in BTUs, easy to transport. So building a few huge plants and then running wires to the rest of it made sense. But the future looks more like what the engineers call distributed generation. It looks more like the internet, millions of people with solar panels or whatever else, putting some energy into the grid and taking some energy out. It looks more like a farmer's market than
So there's a vision for the future when it comes to energy. Bill McKibben, I want to end with just one last question. The End of Nature, which you published in 1989, really the first book to introduce the idea of climate change to the general public. And the idea, for folks who haven't read it, humans have done so much to alter nature that it really doesn't exist anymore. So here we are, more than, a decade and a half later. When it comes to global warming, are you optimistic at all?
Well, we're not going to stop global warming, unfortunately. The best we can do is slow it down, but that's the most important task humans have ever engaged in. We don't know how the story is going to come out. We're getting close to the point where it may be hard to rewrite. That's why it seems so urgent to me that all of us act together fast.
Well, Bill McKibben is the organizer of 350.org. He's also a distinguished fellow at Middlebury College and the author of several books, including The End of Nature. Bill McKibben, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. God bless.
Thank you very much. And the conversation continues. Joni on Twitter says Bill McKibben is Clark Kent. Christopher on Facebook says people can't afford green energy. So the conversation continues at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Jeff Edgers on his interview with conductor Benjamin Zander about his dismissal from the New England Conservatory. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.